The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lotte Hurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. Keep the music flowing. We'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound and the Consequence Podcast Network. I want to thank you for making your way here, checking out this episode. If you're it's your first time, or maybe you're a returning customer but not a subscriber, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere that you like to get your podcast from, you can hit that subscribe. We'll bring you brand new interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday so you can keep up with all of your favorite artists, discover some new ones, and what's happening in the music world. I'm Kyle Meredith, and today I'm going to be talking with Ed Roland of Collective Soul. We get into a lot of things. First off, they're busy. He's busy. It might be quarantine for everybody, but he is not missing the opportunity to make new music. He'll tell us about last year, the follow-up to last year's album, Blood, Vibrating. It was supposed to be a double album. It's still in the cards to release the other half of that, as well as a Record Store Day EP. He says he's done a solo album. He has a brand new band called The Living Room. That's like a new wave Cars type of thing. And Collective Soul have went ahead and recorded another LP. If you're counting along, that's five new albums from Ed Roland. That's not even the bulk of this conversation. What we're really talking about here is the 25th anniversary of the Collective Soul album. The self-titled Blue record that came out in 1995 had the hits December, Gel, The World I Know, Smashing Young Man. It's got a deluxe vinyl edition that's out this month, as well as a vinyl edition of the debut record, Hints, Allegations, and Things Left Unsaid. So we'll be talking about both of those records and what was happening in their lives around that time. You know, it was an interesting time. They were on tour with Van Halen, and while they had number one songs on the radio, plenty of video play on MTV, because of some legal woes, Ed says they were only making $150 a week. I'll say that again, $150 a week. He's going to tell us about that, how Gel ended up on the Jerky Boys soundtrack, blast from the past there, before the album came out. We'll also be talking about the 20th anniversary of Blender. That was their final album with Atlantic, kind of ended that chapter of the Collective Soul book. It's what he calls a searching record. They covered Morphine on it, did a duet with Elton John, but it was a bit of a slept-on record by fans and critics alike. Could there be a potential to remix or redo some of that record in the future? Well, you'll have to hear Ed talk about it. Sounds like it's a possibility. So let's get into it. It's Kyle Meredith with Collective Soul.
Hey!
It's good to see you, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. We just finished
Collective Soul Boys came in, so we were here for 9 days and recorded another record just because we miss each other first and we enjoy making music.
Yeah, what else are you going to do? You know, last time you and I talked was during the last record with Blood, and at that point you had even said it was possibly you'd wanted it to be a double album, that there were songs left over. Are you saying that these are songs beyond those songs?
Yes. So Vibrating, we split Blood up into two records. And so Vibrating was supposed to come out in June. Of course, with everything going on, that's been postponed. So, and we also had an EP we did for Record Store Day, which was in April, but that got postponed. So we have those two in the can. I have a solo record that I did. And then during this virus, I started another band called The Living Room, which is kind of a new wave, Cars. I love that era. And we talked as a band and we decided we just missed each other. We really did. We didn't, but I had songs. So when they got here, I was like, all right, I love you too, but let's get to work. So we just recorded another record.
Wow. No shortage of material. So do you even know how you're going to release it at this point? Any of this?
No. I mean, like I said, Record Store Day, they moved to the end of August this month. So hopefully that comes. If that comes, that's the start of things. A good sign to me. I love, you know, I'm a big vinyl guy. So that's a good start to say we're back on track. And I guess Vibrating, which was the second half of Blood, I think will come out, you know, once we start touring, you know, because we right. thought we'd be touring this summer. And that's why they held it back. So we'll see.
So everything's probably a 2021 release at the year release.
I mean, you know, they're planning tours for 2021, but nobody really knows. I mean,
right.
there's still stuff on books for September. Nobody knows.
Right. Right. Well, you mentioned vinyl, and I'm going to take your cue right there, because one of the things we're going to be talking about today is a new vinyl edition of the 1995 self-titled Collective Soul record. And this is vinyl for the first time, right? A deluxe edition.
Correct.
And Hintz is also getting a vinyl edition as well. They're both both getting out there. And so it's the 25th anniversary. Now, you have many times, in fact, from the beginning, I think, until now, you call this the first official, the real debut record right. from Collective Soul,
right? It really is the debut record of Collective Soul. And, you know, I've said it many times, the first Hintz was just a collection of demos I did over a five-year period at a basement studio. I mean, Shine doesn't even have real drums. It's a drum machine, you know. So this is not Ed sitting in a basement by himself. This is, you know, five guys making music together and figuring out what their sound is, figuring out what Collective Soul wants to sound like and work at it from there.
It's kind of interesting that you say it like that. I mean, you know, figuring out what the sound is, because the album arrived, it sounded like, you know, fully formed, fully conceptualized in there. I mean, the templates that were set on that record, you know, you can still hear throughout your all's career that kind of stuck through there. I mean, finding your sound, it sounds like you didn't have too much of a problem doing that. What were those moments and sessions like?
Well, it was hard work, because once again, it came out 8 months after Hintz did, but we were on the road every day. And so I used sound checks as pre-production. I call it, I'd go in there and go, hey guys, I got this, and, you know, kind of work with them. Cause, you know, I produced it. So I was trying to figure it out, and we all kind of figured, with Shine being the hit, people wanted to hear rock. So we kind of was like, okay, let's go with the rock vibe. We all loved it anyway. I mean, that genre of music. So it was an easy, I don't want to say transition, just an easy formation to go, okay, we're going to do rock, and we're going to throw some riffs in there. And I love writing riffs. I'm a big Cars fan, so I always call Greg Hawkes, the keyboardist of the Cars, one of my favorite riff makers of all time. So I was trying to do that, and we played at shows that night. You know, I wouldn't even have the lyrics done. I would just, you know, do what we used to call back in the day vowel movement, and it formed naturally, but it formed quickly, and it formed out of necessity because we thought we were going to get dropped. So my whole point was, we had every day off, we were in a studio. So, you know, the 5 to 7 shows we did a week, whatever, that next day off during those sound checks, we were working on what songs, whether it was Gel, December, and would go in and record River Flows, which, you know, we were in Lake Tahoe of all places. Who thinks they have a studio in Lake Tahoe? But I, you know, back in the day, you got the old phone book out. You didn't, mm-hmm. you didn't ask Siri, like, hey, what's a studio, recording studio? So we just went at it hard, and I give the guys a lot of credit. They worked really hard and, you know, believed in me and songs and where we were going.
In fact, the last time you and I talked, you talked about even using one of the biggest stages you had ever been on at that point, the Woodstock stage, to write a song basically in front of everyone.
It was Gel. That's the first night lyrics started spewing out. And so they recorded it. So I asked, could I hear it back? And I had about half of, I'd say I got about half of whatever made sense. About half of the song came out that night because I would just splatter stuff out. And I was like, okay, now I got it. Now I got it.
I mean, I might have said this the last time too, but what balls you have to use a stage like that to go, you know what, I'm going to try something here, guys. This we'll see what happens.
I remember having this conversation we've had with other people. Like, literally, I think I knew 2-3 lyrics for that whole set because we were playing new music. Like, we were trying to figure it out. We wanted to go in the studio because we thought we were going to go record before they put Hence out. We didn't even think that was going to be released. Yeah. We thought they'd do Shine and they'd let us go in the studio for a couple of months and make a record, and that didn't happen. So we were really anxious, and there was a big turnover going on at Atlantic Records, and we heard that, you know, if one person got the job, we were going to get dropped. So I was like, well, not before we make a record. So that was the urgency also making the record. I was like, if you're going to drop us, at least I'm getting an album out of this as a band.
Yeah, that's interesting. And once it did come out, I mean, you guys pretty much went full on This Is Us. I mean, I don't know the exact timeline cutoff or how definitive this was, but as far as touring goes, you almost stopped playing Hints altogether, it seemed like. Like, there was Shine.
Yeah.
And otherwise, it was like full on.
Yeah, it was just, it's just Shine. And we've, I mean, over the years, we might have thrown in an acoustic song, but it just didn't fit. I mean, I'm very proud of Hints because it showcases the songwriter I wanted to be, but it doesn't showcase a band. It doesn't showcase a unity. It showcases Ed Roland as a songwriter.
Yeah.
You take that however you want to, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but it didn't showcase a band. And so that was our urgency. It was to go, okay. And we all liked each other. Everybody got along. It was like, okay, let's do this.
One song that seemed to make its way over though, was a B-side to December. And that was an acoustic version of Sister Don't Cry. Was there any reason why that song still kind of spoke to you in that moment? Do you remember?
Well, I think just because if we would have got to re-record, I would have kept that song and Love Lifted Me and Shine. Maybe Good Night, Good Night, Good Guy. There would have been only four, but you know, at the time I was writing so much, I think those would have been the four to start the debut record. Sister Don't Cry was just a personal song for me. It was someone overcoming an addiction, and it was me learning, because once again, you got to remember, you got to back up 5 years when I wrote the song. Though it came out in 93, it was 88 when I was writing these things, and just, you know, being a young 20-year-old and learning about addiction and things like that, and learning to write songs and learning to be comfortable in my own skin, to be personal about my songs without anybody, without naming names. So that song's always meant a lot to me. And I know the guys like it. Shane, actually, the drummer, he played on that in the demo. It's sentimental just because it was a learning curve for me being a songwriter.
Yeah. That song on a much more tamer, much more tamer version, because Hints was, you know, that was a coming of age record for me at the time. And I had a little sister and she cried a lot, and I would literally play that song when she cried. And so, you know, my sister's in her 30s now, you know, I'm nearly 40, and that song still means a lot to us in that way. It's like, oh, that's a song good. I used to play for you, you know?
That's awesome. That's sweet to hear.
You know, we were talking about touring a little bit, and I did want to ask about one of those tours, because Van Halen, I think you ended up on the road with Van Halen. I hope you don't mind the broad question here, but what was that like? I mean, this is 90s Van Halen at that point, so it's not exactly the Diamond Dave moments.
Yeah, Van Halen, Van Hagar, whatever you want to call it. It was, they helped us out so much. I can look back, if they were mentors to us. They taught us how literally to behave. If we wanted to misbehave, here's the consequences that are going to happen if you misbehave. Here's what you can do, and you can stretch it a little bit here. And they were so supportive, and just, you know, we were going through a lot with the manager at the time too, because we had to go through a lawsuit, and they were just all the way around. It was just a blessing to be around them, and still to see those guys, see them once, twice a year. Sammy, he checks on me, I check on him. Michael, like, they were just so kind. It was like parents to little kids. All right, you're getting out of kindergarten now. We got to go to first grade now. This is how you're going to behave.
I mean, if you're going to get the lessons from somebody, that's right.
It was overwhelming. Like I said, we'd have hidden in the bus the whole time had they not, because we're just so overwhelmed. I mean, once, you know, everything happened so quick for us, so we're already like confused. But to sit there and go, it's Eddie Van Halen. I remember the story. I told you our first show with him, Eddie sitting there warming up, and he goes, "Man, I'm really nervous on this tour." I said, "Why?" He goes, "You know, I'm getting my act together, and you know, first time I play, like, you know." I don't want to say sober. He was just like, "I'm getting my act together. I'm just really nervous." And I said, "Well, we have to open for you. You don't think I'm not nervous? So we hit it off immediately. We were like best pals right there.
You mentioned that lawsuit there. I know that was kind of part of the story. Like, here you are 8 months before major success right out of the gates with Shine. You're back in the studio. What was going on with the label? Because this would sort of be a story you and I mean, with the Collective Soul and Atlantic Records, that would weave in and out of the next, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, it was just a manager, just a wrong contract, misunderstandings. I can't really talk about it all, but it just happened at the wrong time. It was like all of a sudden you're on MTV number one and your album selling. God knows, you know, you're Billboard top 200 for 2 years and I can tell you what we're making a week was $150 a week, you know, nobody. So, you know, it's business. And I learned the hard way. We all learned the hard way. It hadn't happened since.
Lessons learned, right? Lessons learned.
Right. That's right.
And I want to bring up Gel one more time too, because that ended up being sort of the first single, if you look at it, because it actually preceded the album. It made its way onto Jerky Boys soundtrack, which I think a lot of people have probably not thought about the Jerky Boys in a little while. But
called a bridge track, they called it back in the days. Bridge right. track.
Was I don't know, was there any story to go along with that? I mean, here's, for a lot of people, this is the next thing that they hear really after Shine.
No, we recorded it. We recorded that in Memphis. I remember recording it. Because it was the first one, we had a day off, and I sent it. Atlantic said, we have something, we want the whole bridge track thing. And I was like, okay, we'll do whatever you want. And I sent it to him, and I was like, it's not the best song I got, but I'm going to give you this. If you're calling it a bridge track, then I want to give you what I consider the best. And damn if it didn't go to number one. And the record label's like, well, that's the worst. What do we got coming? It's like, I don't know. I mean, politics and record companies are hand in hand. It's no different than what goes on in anything else in life.
Well, those songs that did come through, and you know, bringing up December and The World I Know, I mean, you all became a pop chart band, and I'm differentiating that because you've always said, you know, Collective Soul is a pop rock band. I mean, you're right, a pop band in that way, right? But suddenly you are a pop band. I mean, that had to escalate everything.
It did. I don't know what it escalated in, because once again, when we went through the lawsuit, we came home, and my dad knew a guy that had a cow farm, and I was newly married, and we lived in a log cabin on like 250-acre cow farm. I literally went out, cut wood every morning, put in a stove to keep heat. Like it nothing changed on it. It actually went worse. Other than I could see myself on TV and hear myself on the radio. Other than that, I was in dire straits.
Oh man. Talk about the contradiction, the juxtaposition going along.
Yeah, and it was hard at the time. It took years before we could look back, because we were so caught up in just like we were struggling more from success than we were before we had success.
So this all ends up in a deluxe edition now. There's I think 6 new bonus tracks. Most of these, what, they're live, right? And
they're
then
live,
there's one from the Japanese cut. Tell me about that track.
Jesus, I don't even know what it is. What is it? The Y? One track that I remember, we did a Y song. That's why we had Y Part 2, because I'd written a song called Y, and I thought that was... I mean, once again, you go back to that time, we were so big. We had no clue what was going on, other than just making music and playing. My mom actually brought over our itinerary for that first year in 94, and it shows days off, and it shows recording, like, because it was handwritten back then. You got to remember, it's 94. We were doing 25 shows in 23 days, and every day off, it's just day off recording. Like, it's pretty awesome to, there's just looking at it exhausts me now. Much, I don't know how we did it.
Well, the song was That's All Right. That's the Japanese only cuts.
Oh, Elvis.
That's All Right.
I think that's, shit. See, I forgot we even did that. That's all right. That's all right, Mom.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Well, that's going to be
the
deluxe edition.
I want to hear it. I haven't heard it in 25 years. I want to hear it.
So I didn't know the story about Why, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to slip in a little bit of Blender here, because while the first self-titled record is 25, Blender actually celebrates 20 years in 2000, and that was one of the things. I was like, I'm sure it's been answered before, but Why Part 2 was the big single off Blender, and I never knew what Why Part 1 was.
I had a demo of a song called Why, and they wanted a B-side in Japan. Mm-hmm. And so I said, we'll use this. I mean, I had like 15 songs to choose, like from the demos from the basement. So I said, put this on there. It was a little rocker. So I figured it, kind of hold up to shine or whatever, being the same band. And so when I was writing Why Part Two, I kept singing, "Tell me why." And my brother Dean goes, "You know, you idiot, you've already written a song called Why." And I was like, "Yeah, but nobody's heard it, so I'll just put two on there."
It's
part two.
It's nearly like a Traveling Wilburys thing about, you know, volume three without having the volume two. Like, we didn't know what volume one or part one was.
Right. So. Oh, speaking of Traveling Wilburys, look what I was listening to this morning. Little TP.
Yeah, we got the new Wildflowers stuff finally coming out, too. I don't know if you've been hearing any of that. But
yeah, no. You know, he was making that as a double album, too. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, and they didn't. They were like, "We just signed you to a big contract. I don't think we're putting all the money into it." So I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, that's big stuff. Blender, that was it. Would it be your final album with Atlantic? Kind of closed up that chapter right there. And as I said, it turns 20, I believe, in October of this year. That's one of the ones that I think, you know, when I listened to prep for this one, I was like, this is probably the one I haven't heard in the longest.
Mm-hmm.
Man, what a good record. And I'm admitting that I probably slept on it at the time. And I think a lot of people did. I think everybody did. This seems to be one of the records that Collective Soul fans like to debate the most, how they feel about that. How do you feel about this record?
I think we rushed it personally. If you're going to ask me, I'd like two more weeks on it. I think some of the songs on there are great. We were searching. I think it was a searching record. Like, are we going to be rock, pop? What, you know, it was one of those, like, because we weren't getting the attention we felt we deserved from the label. And, you know, at that time, you know, the Counting Crows were coming out, Matchbox 20. So are we going in that direction or this direction? And I was like, fuck it. We're going to go rock. We're just going to do it. And that's why we did the Morphine. The only cover we ever done is Morphine. You know, and I thought that would be a cool vibe, get Atlantic excited, which I think is one of the rockin'est songs we've ever done. You Speak My Language. Mm-hmm. And I presented it to them, and they were just like, just no excitement at all. So that was where we were kind of like, huh, we get it. And I get it. You know, times change, especially at the turn of the century. You know, music change. It seems to evolve that way. Like, you know, 2000, all right, here's the next thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Like the Britney and all that stuff was coming on too. But more of the pop rock, which at that point we'd established and actually enjoyed being more of a rock band. And it's funny, they made fun of us that the record label was like, "You never put your faces on the album artwork." And I was like, I don't want to. And they were like, "You need to do it." And we do it, and they go, "You look like a boy band now." I'm like, can y'all make your freaking mind up?
Well, that was, there's a few little references that happen around that time, because the greatest hits that come after it, calling 7 Year Itch, I always thought was very funny, kind of speaking to the moment there. As I read, you know, what was it, Vent, so maybe comments on what was going on in the business at that point, you know, and there is a thing called band fatigue, fan fatigue for bands, you know, and I think that does naturally happen. And as I was saying, maybe I was going through that at the time, but the amount of melody that you still pull off on an album that, you know, you're saying that you feel like you rush, like when I do hear, geez, the first 5-6 tracks on its own, it's just nonstop hook after hook after hook.
Yeah, and that was our fault. I mean, once again, I agree with you 100%. We should have taken a year or two off just to chill out, you know, because once again, I think you just said we did 5 albums in 6 years, you know, if you include Hints. But that was 5 and 6. Nobody does. I mean, you know, and I got caught up because I write so much that I just wanted to stay busy. I was excited. The adrenaline was kicking in, and so was the guys in the band. Their adrenaline was kicking in. We were excited, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, 6 years prior to that, you know, whoever showed up was just who we were dating at the time. And all of a sudden, here we go, like, let's go. It was a drug in itself, you know, it really was. I think that record would have been really, really good had we taken a year off and then come and made that record. Yeah. That makes sense.
Sure, sure. But in the meantime, you do have great, I mean, 10 Years Later is a great song. I think the duet with Elton now.
That's one of my highlights. I think, to me, that's where I talk about the struggling of the pop to the rock. So you go to that, which I had talked to Elton, and he agreed to do it. And it's funny because I wrote it as an Elton John, like a rock song, a pop song, like he would. And he was upset because he thought I was going to write a collective rock song. And he came in, he's like, "I was going to rock." And I was like, "I thought I was going to get to play 1975 with Elton John, you know, PPD over here."
His piano solo is pretty fantastic in that too. He gets that country flavor on it.
One take.
Not surprised.
One take. One take.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. It was just, I was sat there and I was, Got my money's worth, though. It didn't matter. He played on it. And he did the vocals in three takes just because he had to memorize the words. He did the vocals in three takes. It's just – and nothing to it. I mean, that was it. There's no – when you tune people's vocals.
Auto-tune.
None of that bullshit.
Yeah.
Just nailed it and then said, love, where are we going to go for lunch? I'm like, huh? Wherever you want.
That's an album I think that does deserve a little bit of a critical review.
I'd like to get back
from a lot
in there
of people
and like redo some of that. I like God, what's the one? Because I kind of was listening to the old school Fix at the time. If I turn around, that's one of my favorite songs as a songwriter. I do like that song a lot.
Well, you've got nothing but time these days, at least for the rest of this year. It sounds like so. Why not just along with the 15 other records that you're doing right now.
A remix. Let's do a remix of Blender. We'll blend Blender up a little bit more.
There it is. Well, Ed, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Again, we got the deluxe edition of 95's Collective Soul and the vinyl edition of Hints as well. Both, I'm looking forward to those. And I'm really I loved Blood. I really loved Blood.
I cannot wait
to hear all of these other records that you've got going on.
I'm telling you, Vibrating's the same. But I mean, it was supposed to be a double record, so it's not the B-sides. It was part of the record, and we're excited for everybody to hear it because we listened to it as a band this week, and we're like, that's probably the strongest record. Like, I just wish it had been a double record, but it's really strong. So thank you, as always, for your time. You're awesome.
It's always a pleasure, sir. Take care out there, and I hopefully we'll see you soon.
See you, all right.
Take care. Bye.
Now, Ed and I also caught up in 2019 to talk about what at that point was the brand new record Blood, an album with socially conscious themes. That release lined up with the band's 25th anniversary of Hints, Allegations, and Things Left Unsaid, their debut record. So Ed went on to talk about how the tracks on the album were meant to be demos and yet shot the band to stardom, even landing them on the Woodstock 94 stage. And from there, we talked about 1999's Dosage on its 20th anniversary, which features a pair of classics that ended up on famous soundtracks, Varsity Blues and Twilight. So part two of Kyle Meredith with Collective Soul.
Hey, Kyle, Ed Rowland here.
I got to give the compliments to the new album, Blood. It's as catchy as ever, man. The fact that you are still cranking out such, like, seriously catchy songs is so impressive at this stage. So congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. It's very kind.
So this record, as the press release, it ties it into the 25th anniversary year. And Collective Soul is one of those bands that sort of has, like, two first-year anniversaries, right?
It's kind of like that. It's kind of the band, but the actual demo, the first record was a demo I made in a basement, songwriter demo. So that was kind of 93. So, you know, it's just numbers, man.
No, that's true. But it's nice. I mean, if you want to, you can celebrate that, you know, that beginning for a whole 2 years. You get, you know, 1 year out of 2 years or something
that. Yeah, it's a major release. It's the 25th anniversary. It's when we did the major release of the Hints recordings. Yeah.
I'll tell you, that record meant so much to me. It was one of the life-changing records of my youth, that record. I mean, really, did so much. And
In the right direction.
Well, I mean, here we are, aren't we? So it's...
Yo, there you go. We're still doing it. How about that?
We'll get a little bit of that here in just a little bit, but let's start with the new record with Blood, because... If this does line up with the anniversary year, does this record take stock of the past at all? And if so, how do you do that with still doing something new?
I don't think it takes stock of the old, because like I said, Hints was a demo I made, a batch of demos I made over a 5-year period. So it really wasn't a band. To me, it was just, we thought we were going to get to re-record. And I had some songs and they were like, it became a hit before we even had a major label. So to me, it kind of started with the Blue record, the second one, the self-titled. So we kind of dropped everything, and with the new lineup, Jesse and Johnny added to the band. You know, they had their personalities they brought into it, and we just kind of went something kind of new, because they brought in a whole new energy for us. And not only are they great players, they're great guys, and they kind of, you know, you talk about, like, I had to up my game a little bit because they're so good. And I think they made me a better songwriter. I think they made us a better band. So
it sounds like it, because, you know, it sounds like the sessions went so good. As I read, this was actually, you'd considered this being a double album at one point.
Well, we did. We recorded 22 songs. So we, at first, the idea was to do a double album because I grew up, you know, and a Beatles fan, Elton John fan. So, you know, you had the White Album, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Kiss Comes Alive, the double album's coming up. And to me, it was like, man, we've really done it. We stayed together this long. Let's do a double album. But then management was like, are y'all a bunch of idiots? You know, people don't buy double albums anymore or double CDs. It's streaming now. So we released the first one first, and then the other one will come out next year. I mean, and then maybe we'll put it on a double vinyl for me, just for my own
I would love that.
Reasons.
I mean, that is a hard trick to pull off. You've talked about Elton John through your entire career, and I do have to ask, are you excited about the movie coming out?
I am. Very excited. Very, very, very much. Because, you know, that was my musical hero, other than my parents. But in pop culture, that was the first one. I remember putting the needle on Elton John's greatest hits and me going, I want to do this. I want to write songs. And I wouldn't mind dressing like that every once in a while either. I have no problem with that.
I mean, you ended up having him on a record, which, you know, that had to be a huge moment for you.
Oh, it was, you know, that was my reward, you know, to have your musical hero come in. Because I can remember having dinner with him. I was like, hey, is there any way you'd want to play on a record with us? And he goes, only if you let me sing, love. And I was like, okay. That's the easiest deal I've ever made.
Yes and yes. They ended up on the Blender record, too. So, well, getting back to Blood, you know, we hear Now's the Time, and it sounds like a call to arms for this era. And I feel like maybe that's a theme that threads its way around the songs. Is that accurate?
It is. And, you know, with our culture today, I just feel like, man, everybody's got to chill out, you know. Throwing people in the corner is not going to get you anything except a cat coming out scratching at you. And I just think if we can all, and we can all disagree, but we can do it in a civil way. It just feels like every day is somebody yelling at somebody. And it was just like, man, let's back up for a second. Yeah. Let's just back it up. And there's other issues to deal with that society will always have to deal with. To me, the opioid crisis right now is just out of control, but nobody wants to deal with that. They're too busy calling each other names when there's innocent people that we could really be helping and taking care of or educating about, you know, this crisis.
I feel like that's almost an interesting, you come from an interesting angle geographically because, you know, I'm in Louisville. I'm sort of technically in the South. I don't know. We you know, that's a point of contention around here, but you know, you are steeped in the South, and I think there is, especially with a lot of news about your neighbor in Alabama and everything, there's just sort of a lot of ideas about what the South brings. But coming from a rock band, you come at this from, I guess, a different angle.
I think that has a lot to do with my upbringing. I mean, I came from my father was a minister, so a lot of those preachings, you don't have to dig deep into that, but I mean, it was about love and forgiveness, you know, and to me, that's how you have to live life. I mean, you know, those without sin cast the first stone. So in today's society, they're just casting stones. They don't
right.
give a shit. I think I'm an old soul. And I mean, I've been told that before. I just, you know, it's peace, love and happiness, man.
So with the second single, then A Good Place to Start, I don't know if that follows suit in there, but there's that first line, you know, a man with a gun who thinks he's the chosen one. And again, it feels like that's speaking to a lot of things that we're seeing in the news right now.
Well, I actually wrote it for a homeboy in North Korea, because when I wrote it, that was when that whole tension was going on there. And I was just subliminally throwing it in there. And also, you know, school shootings and everything like that, and the Vegas shootings, because I wrote this right after Tom Petty passed. And, you know, during that week, the Las Vegas shootings and then the North Korea tensions and then Petty passing, it was just a tough week.
Petty comes back around, too. I mean, Petty and Wilco, right? Sort of as a touchstones for parts of this record?
Yeah, we started, right as Rain started, I had another group called Sweet Tea Project, which was more roots-based. You know, we had a banjo and a trumpet, you know, things that my brother and Collective Soul would punch me in the face if I brought into Collective Soul. and then Jesse and Johnny and Will would line up behind him. But anyway, I had presented it to Sweet Tea. I thought it was kind of in that vein. And they were like, no, this is Collective Soul. And I was like, okay. So when we sat down with the song, they were like, yeah, we hear this. And then we kind of went, what do we feel? And we just put on a Wilco record. And I was like, well, I love those guitar tones. Let's just start with that tone there. And then we had the day we recorded it, a dear friend of ours, Peter Stroud, who plays Sheryl Crow and Sarah McLachlan, was in town. And not only a dear friend, but I mean, one of the best guitar players on the planet. So I was like, well, come on over. We'll break bread and we're going to record. keyboard and you're going to play slide guitar. And that's kind of how it all went.
Yeah.
It was real easy. I mean, we record real quick. We do a song a day. I just feel like at this point, the guys, we catch that moment and go. We don't linger on it. It's just, let's get it done. That feels right. And let's go.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Peter Stroud. I got to know him in the last year, thanks to Cheryl and her band. And to hear that he's on the record.
Yeah, he did it. I mean, like I always said, it's kind of great to have not only Peter's talent, but to have him as a friend and have one of your heroes, and they play on the record, man.
And another one, Tommy Shaw's on the record, right?
Yeah. So we're all over the place on this. I've known Tommy, oh God, for years, because I sang on a solo record of his in 99, 20 years ago. And I'm a big Tommy Shaw fan, and he was kind of inspiring to me back in the day because I loved his look. I loved how he sang, how he played, and he was a Mobile, Alabama boy, too. So it was kind of an inspiration that you can be from the South and end up on the big stage at some point. So I called, and I had this song, Porch Swing, and I thought that Tommy's really into the dobro and mandolin. So I thought if I could get him to play a little dobro, I thought the song was a good way to end the record, and the guys did too. And I was like, how cool would it be to have one of your heroes? Just the last thing you hear is Tommy Shaw singing. So I called him, and I said, we're not trying to sound like Styx, and we're not trying to sound like Collective Soul. It's a little different for us, and I sent it to him, and he called back. He goes, I've got it. And I'm like, go for it.
I don't know. So Peter Stroud, Tommy Shaw, Peter Searcy playing on the record. Of course, we're big fans of him around here. Is there anybody else? Because it sounds like there's a party happening already.
There was. I mean, we kind of have that mentality. Yeah, Christian Bush, who played with Train, Sugarland, he played organ for us. It was just, you know, whoever was home at that time, our pals, and they played instruments. We were like, come on over. Once again, go break bread, and then we'll make some music.
Yeah.
But that's how it should be to me. I mean, it's camaraderie and it's supposed to be fun. And if you can have your friends like Peter Searcy, and, you know, you get people like that are just, once again, not only talented, but just good people that you enjoy being around. Why not, man?
I mean, it comes back to that title with blood, you know.
Right. Correct. And that's that was the whole vibe we were going for. I mean, because literally we set Johnny's drums up. We'd horseshoe around him. We put amps in a closet or outside. We didn't care, you know, because we recorded it at my house. And then just, once again, it was just more family. It was like a family picnic every day we recorded.
I love the way it's turned out. I really did. I mean, again, you have such a knack for melody and for this pop perfection in songwriting that's completely respectable. So, you know, hats off to that.
Thank you so much. That's very kind.
I do want to hit on a few of these anniversaries, you know, kind of real quick, you know, as we talk about that 25th and heading back, picking up something you said, and you've said many times that hints, allegations, things left unsaid, what was, you know, demos. Have you ever wanted to go back, especially after having time with those songs through the years, and maybe make what you would have called a finished version of those songs? Although I have trouble saying that because of how close I am with those songs.
We actually went back and re-recorded Shine just because I couldn't take any more hearing a damn drum machine on it. I just couldn't. It was killing me. And but no, I think once again, I go back to what I finally settled in on was it wasn't the power of production. It wasn't the power of performance. It was the power of the songs. And I come at ease with that. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't a band. It was Ed, Mad Professor, in a basement on an 8-track machine, just trying to come up with get a publishing deal, you know. As I've always said, you know, at that time I was 30 years old when we put it together. I mean, it wasn't like Atlantic Records was going, where's that 30-year-old rock star? Yeah, Ed. and at the same time, it's not only a blessing but a curse, because the song was so big, so quick, that I think most of our songs did that. It overshadowed that when we did become a band, that it, you know, we were catching up to all our songs, and bands became bigger than their songs. Our songs are bigger than the band. So, you know, we've always had to work through that. I mean, there's festivals we do, and there's these huge bands, and they'll come up and they'll go, God, we didn't know that was you. And I was like, yeah, been hearing that my whole life. That's okay though.
You played a big festival that year in 94, and talking about Woodstock, which, as I look back on it, you got tapped on that. You were so new. You were such a new band. And when you think about that, you know, lineup of legends in some way, did you feel like the little guys on that stage at that point?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we really didn't have – I was writing the record because we were so nervous about the hints, just because it wasn't a band. So, you know, when we played Woodstock, I think the only song we really knew were – Love Lifted Me and Shine, but I would write songs at sound and then show it to the guys at soundcheck, and then didn't even have lyrics. I would just do the vowel movement thing. People didn't hear, know, or care. But then that night they were taping it, so I mumbled enough words out of jail that I wrote jail lyrically kind of that night. But we just kind of approached it in that way. We kind of went, you know what, this, let's go with it. It's fun. And we had nobody really helping us from the label because we're so new. There was nobody from the label there with us. We were just sitting in our room by ourselves while everybody else had, you know, caretakers, A&R people, press. And we're just sitting there by ourselves. And then, like, I remember King's X walked by and we all looked at each other and we're like, should we go say hey? So we started following him around the fields. And finally, Doug turned around and go, what do y'all want? We were like, we just want to say, hey, we don't know how to do it. We were just naive and shy. And, you know, 2 weeks before that, we're rehearsing in my parents' basement, you know, and then we do Woodstock. And then 2 days later, we're with Aerosmith. So wow. A lot happened real quick.
That's still so funny to think. I hear you have, you know, one of the biggest stages of that year and of that era. And you're writing songs basically, you know, live in front of this crowd. That's balls.
You gotta write them sometime.
Being 30 when the band broke, do you think that gave you different perspective than had it happened earlier for you?
Yes, by far. Business-wise, definitely, because I'd understood the business at that point, because I, you know, there's so many close calls. And you kind of go, okay, well, what can I learn from this? From, you know, not giving your publishing up to, like, owning your own material, owning your art. And when we got signed, I did that. I was like, you know, I'll take a chance. I mean, I'm 30. I already took a chance. So that part of it helped a lot. And I think having the rest of the guys who are like 10 years younger than me just kind of follow me a little bit, but yet, you know, they were learning their gig too, if that makes sense. So it was a great, I always call it, that first year was like pre-production. Most bands get signed and they get a year to go do pre-production and record. That was us doing it in front of a live audience, which I think helped build confidence in what we were as musicians.
A hell of a year anyway to get started.
I know. But I'm like, holy smokes.
Dosage is turning 20, as you mentioned earlier. I think it was maybe a February anniversary specifically this year. How do you see that record? You know, as I look back on it, it seemed like, you know, a lot of bands who did get their start in the early and mid 90s, the spotlight had started to move, and maybe that had happened a little bit with Discipline Breakdown. But here it is. I mean, this was a huge success of a record. I think it surprised people as I go back and read the reviews.
It was the first one where we were kind of accepted critically. And that was the beginning of the downfall of Atlantic Records with us, because we thought we had made a perfect pop rock, rock pop, whatever you want to call it, record. And it was the first time we really got to spend time in the studio. We were self-indulgent making that record. We took a long time, spent too much money, and also experimented with different things from loop that no rock band had done at that point, really. And I look back on it, and I remember the time making it more than I do the songs. I think we stretched it, I think, just the right amount so we didn't lose our core audience. But I think it's held up quite nicely, you know?
Really well.
A couple of things I always want to change, but, you know, I, like I said, I'll never forget, we released Heavy, and the label wouldn't do a video. They wanted to see what it'd do at radio. So it went to number one, and I called again. I was like, can we make a video? And they're like, well, let's just see what it does. I'm like, it's number one. This went on for 15 weeks, because it was number one for 15 weeks. And finally, on the 15th week, I said, I guess we're not making a video. And that's when I kind of knew they just kind of were just letting us float through the system. Nobody was cheerleading for us.
It's insane, really. I mean, a number one record. I remember hearing Heavy for one of the first times, and it's sounding just so different. And at that moment, even futuristic, if that's not painting it too hard there.
No, there were, that was kind of where, you know, some of that was where we were going for that record, you know, from the intro to Tremble to No More, No Less, you know, with the loops of glass breaking. We were having fun. And like I said, experimenting and just doing what we truly wanted to do. We were not afraid to. One night, once again, nobody from the label was in the studio. We never had anybody in the studio. I don't think they even knew we were making the record, to be honest with you. So it was that freedom, and, you know, there was nothing right or wrong. Now, you could disagree to put that on there, but it was that freedom we enjoyed. Like I said, it was the first time we got to really record in a proper studio, like, for a length of time.
I know you write songs, artists write songs, and they put them out in the world, and you sort of have to let go of them at some point to become whatever they're going to become. Having a song like Run, you know, which is this amazing classic that still sounds great, it's associated for a lot of us with a movie, a Varsity Blues movie, which is a movie very much stuck in an era on top of that.
Right.
Has that ever, you know, sat with you in any one way or the other, knowing that there is a large group of people who sort of have that association?
I do know that. It doesn't bother me at all, because that's what you're supposed to. It is a time capsule, music is. I mean, the first time you hear something, you go, oh, I can remember what I was doing, or how old I was, or what girl I was dating. So that's the song that I think people that surprised us. We knew he loved that song, but it's the one that it once again, Atlantic released it, didn't really push it, but now it's like when we play it live, we end the show with that, and that's the song everybody waits for, which is strange because we play Shine like third or fourth in the set, and then we play Run last. You would think it'd be the opposite way, but that they kind of wait for Run.
And then it's worth mentioning Tremble for My Beloved. It goes on to have a second life once Twilight comes out years later.
Yeah, that brought in a whole new younger generation. And it's funny, we didn't have it in the set on this this tour, and Jesse, our lead guitarist's girlfriend, who's 30 years old, I guess, said, why are you not playing Tremble? And I was like, but she only knew it because of the soundtrack, which is great. There was another generation that came in and heard Collective Soul and loved what we did. So to end the story, we put the song back in the set.
Smart move.
For Jesse's girl. For Jesse's girl, not Rick Springfield, Jesse's girl, our Jesse's Jesse's girl.
It's a very smart move right there. It's a great song on top of that. So that helps, by the way, that it's a great song.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this. The new record is called Blood. You're going to be on tour this summer. You're going to be touring with the Gin Blossoms, right?
We are, yeah. Love those guys. Great guys.
Dude, thank you so much. Congratulations on Blood. It's another triumph, and I really mean that.
No, thank you so much. That's so kind. And thank you for your time.
Yeah, you too. And we'll see you out there.
All righty, bud.
All right, take care.
See ya.
Bye.
All right.
My thanks, Ed Roland with Collective Soul, 25th anniversary edition of the self-titled record, vinyl editions of that one, and Hints, Allegations, and Things Left Unsaid. My thanks to you as well for checking out this episode. Before you get out, again, I hope if you enjoyed yourself, you hit that subscribe button. You can find us at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere you get your podcasts from. Just type in Kyle Meredith with subscribe. We'll bring you three new interviews every single week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. After that, head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. That's an hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. WFPK.org, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Shit, you're gonna make me change clothes already?
I'm Lior Phillips, host of This Must Be the Gig. We're a weekly podcast that documents everything about the world of live music. Speaking with choreographers, costume and set designers, the people who run beloved venues and festivals, and, of course, speaking with musicians about that one gig that changed their lives. Get your peek behind the curtain at consequenceofsound.net, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.